listen to the best of the church's music for the season of Lent at LutheranPublicRadio.org. Sacred music for the season of Lent, LutheranPublicRadio.org.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Well, the Fourth Estate, the media, they have a role to play, even early on, not only after men are elected to high office, but before they are elected, in fact, even when they aspire to be elected. Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker has decided to test the waters of a possible bid for the presidency in 2016, and so the press is doing its job. They have part of that vetting process in asking certain questions of the potential candidate. Now, given the fact that Scott Walker he's a Republican, he's also a Protestant evangelical, that means there's a certain set of questions that the press is automatically going to ask him. And they have been doing that as well. How well have they been doing it? Joining us to talk about media coverage of Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker's religious background, Richard Osling. He's a regular guest, longtime religion writer for the Associated Press and Time magazine, recipient of the Lifetime Achievement Award from the Religion News Writers Association, and he's a contributor to GetReligion.org. Richard, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Thanks a lot.
Is the press simply doing its due diligence or kind of doing its part in the vetting process of Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker on the social issues?
Yes, I think so. You could distinguish between two types of social issues. When he was in Britain, he was asked about evolution. Okay, let's say Walker, you know, has doubts about evolution or sees it being used to attack religious faith or whatever. You could say, well, that doesn't really affect the presidency of the United States. But I think it's a legitimate question because the president in this country sort of fuses the British prime minister with the queen. In other words, not only the head of government and administrator and executive, but also sort of a symbolic head of the country. So looking at that broader role of the president, I think everything that Walker thinks about this and that is of interest and possible relevance. Now, it's more obvious on issues like same-sex marriage or abortion, where government does have a role. And I think conservatives who have strong feelings on those issues, but also liberals who want government to butt out and so on, it's a legitimate question for either side. And frankly, I think the governor has not adequately thought through his position on some of these things, and it makes him look, as the cliche goes, not ready for prime time. He seems like a pretty sharp fellow who I think is going to, you know, get up to speed pretty quickly, but there have been a few rough patches for him.
Well, it does behoove anybody, much less a state governor here who might have his eye on a presidential run, to realize, and I assume I'm correct here, that there is a stock set of questions that if you are Republican, Protestant, evangelical, whatever it may be, you are going to be asked those questions, which will probably not be either asked or pressed as closely with your Democratic counterparts.
No, I think that's true. You have a Democrat running for president. You can assume what their view is on gay marriage or abortion or stem cell research that destroys human embryos or whatever the issue is. A somewhat different and interesting question was Walker's asked, do you think Obama is a Christian? And as with evolution, his initial instinct was to duck the question. I mean, he didn't want to get into it. But, you know, these sort of things are going to come up. And I think, I honestly think it's a legitimate question, because it's been raised, you know, in the general discourse of American life. And, you know, there's a certain percentage in polls who say, well, we think the president is Muslim, and that affects your feelings toward him and so on. I suspect his hesitation on that, he's thinking to himself as an evangelical Protestant, well, what does this mean? It means more than just going to church or having my name on, you know, the church roll somewhere. But it means a conscious, dedicated commitment of the life to Christ. And I haven't sat down to talk with Mr. Obama. I don't have any idea what his thinking is. So from the religious standpoint, like if you're in a living room and you're chatting among folks who share your theology, it's a legitimate question to kick around. But in public life, it has much broader implications. And I frankly think he should have said, well, Mr. Obama identifies himself as a Christian, and I take him at his word, or that's between the president and God, or something of that sort, rather than just trying to duck it altogether.
Another question that was posed to him was, do you think that President Obama loves America? Where did that one come from?
Right. That came out of the blue from Rudy Giuliani, the former mayor of New York. Frankly, it was kind of a strange thing to say about the president. It's one thing to say, I think his policies are not good for the country or even doing damage to the country. But to judge motives like that the president does not love his country, implies that you can only love the country if you're a conservative Republican or you share my views on this, that, or the other. And I think that was offensive even to Americans who might be Republicans, might be politically conservative, and might have had a very high opinion of Mr. Giuliani for his leadership in New York City after the 9/11 attacks.
What do we know about Governor Walker's religious affiliation, if not his political and social views?
Right. Like many of the Republicans running this year, he's a religiously interesting fellow. For one thing, he's a preacher's kid. His dad was a pastor in the American Baptist churches. And he currently attends Meadowbrook Church west of Milwaukee. And this is a really remarkable situation in southeast Wisconsin. There's a congregation called Elmbrook Church, which started from scratch a generation ago. And through itself and through churches it has planted, it's responsible for 12 new congregations in the city of Milwaukee and in the surrounding suburbs and exurbs. So one church produces 12 congregations, one of which is the one that Mr. Walker attends. So, I mean, that's really a remarkable story in and of itself.
Let's talk a little bit about another piece that has appeared that is talking about the basic distinctions, very basic distinctions, between what are called kind of the three Abrahamic religions. Where did we find this, and what did you find there?
Yeah. I think Peter Berger, the noted Boston University sociologist, put it well. He said, after 9/11, there was an upsurge in talk about the Abrahamic religions, that is, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, that all look back to Abraham as a founder or forefather. Now, as he said, there was a well-meaning instinct there. In other words, people wanted to head off anti-Muslim bigotry after 9/11, and so they talked about, oh, the three religions, you know, are close to each other or share this common heritage and so on. And as he says, very much like the talk about Judeo-Christian religion starting in the 1950s, which is aimed at heading off anti-Jewish prejudice, making Jews more part of the American mainstream. The problem with that, as Berger and also John Levinson at Harvard Divinity School point out, yes, they all share Abraham, but they share Abraham in a way that excludes the other two religions. In other words, Abraham is as much a point of difference and disagreement as he is a point of unity. So I think particularly Levinson's book on this Inheriting Abraham in 2012 created quite a bit of discussion, and I think, frankly, more realism about the relations among these three faiths.
This, of course, is of great necessity and currency, simply because we are faced on a daily basis with the struggle to understand Islam in relationship both to Judaism, and we're talking here about the threats in the Middle East, but also in relationship to Christianity, at least as it is viewed by Islam as personified in the West. Talk about that, if you would.
No, that's true. Just for simplicity, let's leave Judaism aside for a moment. But thinking about the Christian-Muslim situation, I mean, it is becoming lethal in the Mideast. I mean, kidnappings, sex slavery, slaughter of people who don't share the views of a particular Muslim cult, I think I would call it. I mean, this is very serious stuff. There are important ways in which the Muslim tradition, expressed in the Quran, the Holy Scriptures, and the Hadith, which are authoritative traditions of Muhammad's own teachings, this material can lead or should lead to a respect for Christians, despite the disagreements. But all of that much developed tradition over centuries in Islam and from its authoritative teachers seems to be going by the wayside with this new radical faction, which is growing and has surprising sympathy from a segment of the world's Muslim population. It's very, very concerning, and I think it violates, the best I can understand it, the words from Muhammad and the word of God in the scriptures as supposedly believed by Muslims.
So if you could add a paragraph or two to, I don't know if it would be kind of a journalistic style book or maybe a handbook that would sit on an editor's desk, when it came to the issue of the basic differences between Christianity and Islam, laying aside the fact that they both claim Abraham for two very different reasons, how would those paragraphs read, just to kind of inform the average journalist when they're saying, okay, I got to bone up on what the real differences between Christians and Muslims really are?
Well, you have, of course, different scriptures. And coming out of that, the key belief would regard Jesus Christ and whether he is God the Son in the Holy Trinity, an object of worship, as being divine. To Muslims, and for Jews, for that matter, that's a very offensive doctrine. Christians believe they are not violating monotheism, that is, worship of the true one God, by believing in the Trinity and believing in Christ's divinity. So if you want to pick one thing, that would be it. There's some interesting overlaps. Christians may not be aware that in Islam, Jesus is the Messiah. He is in the line of prophets that ends up with Muhammad. He was born of a virgin, Mary, and he worked miracles. In fact, the miracles in the Quran are a little more astonishing in some ways than the miracles we find in the New Testament. Also, Jesus plays a part in the end times. The second coming of Jesus is taught in Islam. So there are these correspondences, even though Jesus is merely a human, a remarkable human, a God-fearing human, but not divine. So if I pick one thing, that would be it. I mean, we could go into a lot of other things, but I'd say that's the heart of the disagreement.
Do you think that that in general, the people who cover the religion angle of stories that have to do with Islam and Christianity in the same story, do you think they're generally getting that right in the media?
Well, removing it from that one point, I would say probably people grasp that. But frankly, the coverage of religious matters when it's handled by political reporters is usually not adequate, or often. And also, newspapers and so on are cutting back on having religion specialists on staff, people that you can check with, or else have them write about these matters. So I think and television is far worse than that. So I think we do have a problem in the media grasping the essentials and being accurate in depicting these faiths.
Dick Ausling is a longtime religion writer for the Associated Press and Time magazine. He's a recipient of the Lifetime Achievement Award from the Religion News Writers Association, and he's a contributor to GetReligion.org. Dick, thanks for being our guest.
Sure, glad to be with you.
We do sermon reviews here on Issues, Etc., and more often than not, we will do a positive sermon review. We listen to someone to see, this is what you should be listening for on Sunday morning, this Christ-centered, cross-focused preaching. Every once in a while, we'll throw in what I call maybe a negative sermon review. Tomorrow, we're going to be reviewing a sermon by Bill Hybels. He is the head pastor of one of the largest mega churches in the United States up there in Chicago. A new sermon series he's starting on Unwavering, a story of obedience. We'll review it tomorrow, and we'll continue our series on Christ in the Old Testament, talking about the Ten Commandments with Pastor Brian Ketchelmeyer. I'll talk with you tomorrow.
Listen weekday afternoons to Pastor Todd Wilkin and guests on Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is vital for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our mailing address, Issues Etc., P.O. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. You can also donate at our website, issuesetc.org. Issues Etc. is a production of LPR, Lutheran Public Radio.
Chris Roseborough talking about his presentation at this summer's Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference.
We're going to take a look at the ecclesiastical model employed by much of American evangelicalism today, especially as put forward by the seeker-driven movement. We're going to take a look at where this idea of a vision-casting leader comes from, what its main tenets are, and we're going to compare that so-called ecclesiastical office to the biblical office of pastor, to see if the two are actually synonymous and interchangeable, or if this concept of a vision-casting leader actually turns a pastor into a false prophet.
You can meet and hear Chris Roseborough making the case against vision-casting leaders in the church June 19th and 20th at the Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference in Collinsville, Illinois. For more information, visit issuesetc.org or call 618-223-8385. The Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference.